This is America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard on listeners-sponsored digital radio. Around the world, the web at NachumSiegel.com and the Nachum Siegel Network, and of course, the beloved NSN app. Excuse me. Rabbi Stephen Przanski is with us live via telephone. He is in Israel, of course. He's Rabbi Emeritus of Congregation B'nai Yeshurun here in Teaneck, New Jersey. He's Israel Region Vice President of the Coalition for Jewish Values, Senior Research Associate at the Jerusalem Center for Applied Policy, and we always turn to him for analysis about these interesting times that we're in. Rabbi Przanski, a pleasure to welcome you back to JM in the AM.
Thank you, Nachum. Good morning to you and all your listeners.
Appreciate that. You being, of course, from the U.S., have an appreciation for this unique period of time that we're in just a few days before Inauguration Day. Most generally, over the years, people associate that with pardons and you know, hoping for a peaceful transition. I mean it like that, not as a criticism to the outgoing or incoming administration, but more you don't want, you know, countries around the world taking advantage of the U.S. during a time of change like that, et cetera, et cetera. Now, of course, we have an added element, and that is that there is a declaration by the incoming president that Inauguration Day is going to mean a heavy hand being applied to the enemies of Israel if the hostages are not released. What are your feelings when you hear a threat like this from the incoming White House, and does it give you hope, or does it give you greater reason to despair?
Well, firstly, I do believe that the interval between the election and the inauguration is just too long. It's 2.5 months. No other country in the world has that big an interval. It made sense in pre-modern times, but now almost every other country in the world transitions that take maybe a week or two and no longer.
And it used to be longer, by the way.
It used to be March 4th, correct, right. But you're too young to remember that. but secondly, it is therefore a dangerous period for Israel in the sense that the outgoing administration can make demands or do all sorts of hazardous, reckless acts without any accountability.
And we've seen
because
that.
Because we saw that in the Obama administration, when in the last weeks of his term, before Trump took over in 2017, he approved the resolution in the United Nations Security Council, or abstained from it, although he did mastermind it, stating essentially that Yerushalayim, the old city, does not belong to Israel. Right. And does not belong to the Jewish people, as well as an attack on Jewish settlement in Judea Samaria. So thirdly, regarding Trump's statement about a heavy hand that will apply to our enemies, I hope it's true. I hope, therefore, Israel does not rush into a reckless deal that jeopardizes our security in the next week, all to accommodate Biden and to try to avert Trump's threat of hell to pay if an agreement is not made. Because as we know, we like him very much, but he can be a little blustery in his threats. He says a lot of things for negotiation purposes to make statements, but doesn't necessarily carry them out. Nonetheless, there is tremendous pressure growing in Israel for a deal quickly, and the vibes that I'm getting are not necessarily positive ones.
And that would be because, no matter how you view it, if there's going to be any pressure, there's only a week left. He's now in office, meaning a week from now. He's now in office, and therefore this has to be done immediately. Once the pressure is applied to Israel by either administration, there's no win for Israel. They're going to have to agree to release prisoners and agree to a deal they simply don't want to get involved with.
Yes, the assumption is, and it's almost unspoken about until the last few days, the assumption is that we're not going to achieve the release of our hostages in exchange for a ceasefire, which all in all would be a very positive outcome. We're expected not only to have a ceasefire, but to withdraw our troops from territory that we've conquered now several times, Jabalia, Beit Hanun, Beit Lahia, etc., would have to go back with tremendous cost to the lives of our soldiers, not to mention that this is the seventh time we're fighting over Gaza and have conquered it since 1948, which is in itself an unprecedented absurdity that only Israel is subjected to. But in addition to that, to be expected to release into the mainstream thousands of terrorists and murderers, knowing that they will return to terror. It's interesting, the listener should know, one of the demands being made by Hamas is that in the first batch of the terrorists that we're expected to release are those terrorists who were freed as part of the Shalit deal and then rearrested for committing acts of terror. I mean, that's insane. It is immoral. It's stupid because we are undoing all the positive accomplishments of the war, and we are thereby ensuring the survival of Hamas. You see, we're dealing with a fundamental problem that I actually wrote about the very first week of the war when the prime minister announced the three objectives for the war. For the two objectives that are paramount are the destruction of Hamas and the release of all the hostages. Mm-hmm. And I said then, and I reiterate today, as painful as it sounds, those two objectives are incompatible without a miracle. They're incompatible. Hamas will never free all the hostages, never, because they will then lose any capability of survival. These are their trump cards, forgive the pun. So they'll never release them. And they'll hide behind the fact that indeed they don't know where all of them are, or that many of them are dead, killed, murdered in cold blood. And we're expected to let murderers out in order to gain their release, endangering the rest of society. 50% of these terrorists are recidivists. I was listening this morning on the radio to Lieutenant General Maurice Hirsch, who for many years until the Shalit deal dealt with these exchanges. And he said 50% of these prisoners, terrorists, please go back to terror the very next day. And having served time in Israeli prisons, they become more hardened, more committed to their cause. So it's not a question of freeing the lives of hostages whose names we know, because it's all speculative what will happen in the future. It's not speculative. People in Israel, Jews, will die, will be killed as a result of these murders being released. The only thing we don't know are the names of the future victims. But that there will be future victims, that's a guarantee. And we have to stop. We have to stop this absurdity of releasing murderers in exchange for innocent hostages, because all that does is incentivize the taking of hostages in the future. That will be the goal of Hamas or Hezbollah or any other group. They'll invade a community, let's say, God forbid, somewhere in Judea, Samaria. They'll kill five people and they'll take two hostage, because they know Israeli society emotionally collapses at the thought of hostages in captivity. And there's no doubt it is painful. It's agonizing. But nonetheless, you have to stand up and say, Ad Kan, we can't do this anymore. We can't go through the same process of releasing terrorists to commit more terror, of surrendering land only to have captured again at a terrible cost in the blood of our soldiers. It is literally insane to do the same thing over and over again and expect different results. And I'm hopeful the prime minister can stand up to the pressure, which is enormous in this society, not to mention coming from the Americans and the Europeans, stand up to the pressure, because that will be his legacy. He didn't stand up to the pressure for the Shalit deal, and it led inevitably to the attacks of October 7th.
Wow. So unless he has the guts, so to speak, to stand up to the majority of Israeli society, and I'm not condemning anybody who's protesting and fighting on behalf of their family members who are being held captive, but you get my point. Unless he stands up to them and to their efforts and the efforts of the outgoing and incoming administrations, because we're getting a feeling, and you're certainly describing what to likely expect from them. If he can't stand up to everybody collectively, then Hamas basically lives on.
Hamas, if Hamas lives on, then Hamas has won.
Yeah.
Imagine the moral obscenity of, in exchange for getting the body of the murdered Jew on October 7th, to free a person's murderer. How can you imagine anything that's more obscene? And it is very painful, and I don't begrudge any family of a hostage protesting and arguing, etc. But they're not the decision makers. They're suffering through an emotional trauma. And I would hope the decision makers could be a little more dispassionate, objective in analyzing the pros and cons of any deal and what strengthens Israel in the future. Because the fact is, if thousands of murderers are released and we get back, who knows, 30 hostages that are alive, then, and Hamas is still in existence, and they get billions of dollars from the world to rebuild Gaza. And by the way, it takes 2 weeks to renovate a tunnel that's been collapsed. That's it. And they get a chance to rebuild and refurbish and revive their terror infrastructure. In fact, Hamas lost. I'm sorry, Hamas won. I can't even say it. And we lost.
Even a tunnel that has literally collapsed from whatever type of weaponry Israel has used to destroy it, even a tunnel like that, in just a matter of days and weeks, it can be rebuilt?
Yes, because the walls are still there. In other words, the dirt collapses on it, but the walls are still there. So you need the heavy machinery just to redig, lift up the dirt, refurbish the tunnel. They can even go deeper, and they're back in business. If we don't destroy Hamas, there should be no life in the settlements around Gaza, because it's going to happen again. And it's the same thing in the north. We can't countenance the situation. And of course, one way to avert the whole problem is, at a certain point, to go after the head of the snake, which is Iran. And I think there is a hope in the Israeli government that the Trump administration will be much more forthcoming, even with American assistance, in that, towards that end, than the Biden administration was.
It's interesting, the way you're describing things. It's very possible that the Trump administration will be more helpful with Iran than they would be with Hamas.
Yes. Look, Trump hates Hamas for whatever reason. The Biden administration, even Jack Lew said yesterday, the ambassador here, that the destruction of Hamas is not an American goal.
Right.
It is a Trump goal, and it's a very worthy goal. I mean, these people are murderers, the worst type of murderers. And I had a terrible thought today that there'll be, if the hostages are released in with the worst possible deal, the media and the families will trumpet this as a tremendous victory, and there'll be great joy, and there'll be celebrations and music, etc. And I'm thinking to myself, it's not joy, it's relief. Right. It's the relief that we would feel had we lived then, when Holocaust survivors emerged from that Gehenna.
Right.
There's no joy. It's relief they survived, with the realization of the terrible suffering they endured and the terrible price we paid. But the big difference is that when the Holocaust survivors emerged, the Nazis were destroyed.
Right.
Here, the survivors will emerge, the hostages, but the Nazis are still there and planning to attack another day. And that is unconscionable, immoral. No government, no Israeli government, would have any legitimacy if it allowed that to happen.
Rabbi Stephen Przanski with us from Israel. Does anybody in Israeli media, journalists, commentators, analysts, do any of them discuss whether there are tunnels similar to the ones in Gaza, in Judea and Samaria?
Sure. It's actually come up in the last 12 months, because the reports from various settlements is that they've heard at night machinery digging. And these were the same reports that happened for years in the settlements that adjoin the Gaza Strip.
Right.
And it was ignored then. And the army has taken to saying that they're hearing things, it's not true, which is the exact same thing they said to the settlements around Gaza. Look, there is, unfortunately, a lack of trust in Israel now of the army leadership. There's tremendous trust and gratitude for the courage and professionalism of the soldiers. The sacrifice is unbelievable, and it's something that history will record. The people left their homes and the reservists came out and served in astonishing numbers. But there's a distrust of the general staff. The chief of staff was being pressured now to resign. The assumption is he might be gone by the end of the month. He doesn't have the right stuff in terms of envisioning a strategic vision or in articulating a strategic vision and then carrying through on it. There already was a resignation this week of the deputy chief of staff because he does not like the way the war is being conducted. And there's that type of a distrust. And our society cannot long tolerate that. You have to have trust that the army has the soldier's best interest at heart and has a vision of what the end is to be. And I could tell you, even the commanders on the ground now, who, of course, they want to achieve the mission and protect the soldiers, they are balking at having to return to the same place every 60 days because they conquer it, they kill the terrorists, they drive them out, they leave, and the terrorists return. It's a terrible loss of life that's completely unnecessary. The bottom line is I've always subscribed, as did the world until it came to Israel, to what Napoleon said, that a nation's borders are located where its soldiers' graves are.
Right.
Attacked, we conquer that land. That is our land. And if international law does not accept that, well, then I have news for the world and for your listeners. Our morality is superior to that morality. And part of Israel being a light unto the nations is to propagate our real morality and try to supplant the world's fake morality. And I say it's fake because it only applies to Israel. No other nation is forced to give up land that it conquered in a defensive war.
When Israel is allowed to win a war, they'll be able to display their real morality.
That's correct. Correct. But Israeli society has to come to that place also, and it hasn't yet. It's still, the delusions of Oslo still exist. They've receded somewhat, but they still exist.
So just technically, in terms of the news that you just brought up, so Amir Bahram is gone, deputy chief of the IDF, correct? That's the one.
Right.
And now they're trying to pressure Herzi Halevi to actually leave his position. And
yes,
are there more qualified people on the horizon?
I think there are. It's not for me to say, but I think there are. And I have to give a positive word about the new defense minister, Yisrael Katz. Yoav Gallant, he was a dedicated soldier for many years. We give him credit for that.
Right.
He was too enthralled with Herzi Halevi, and they worked in tandem, and frankly, they failed in tandem. But Yisrael Katz comes from the outside. He's not from the Marechet, you know, from the military system.
Right.
He's an outsider. And so he's able to look at things with an unjaundiced and clear eye and say, this is not working. Herzi Halevi is trying to promote different people, including some people responsible for the debacle on October 7th before he's forced to leave his office. And Yisrael Katz stopped that. And he said, no, you don't have the right to do that. I mean, it's an absurdity. What's come out in the last week apparently is an Israeli slogan that I only heard last week for the first time, but apparently it's a sensibility that exists. The army feels that it's an army that has a country. Rather, this is a country that has an army. That type of hubris is one of the reasons why we suffered the catastrophe that we did. It's not an army that has a country alongside it. It's a country that has the army, and it's up to the civilian leadership to rein in that army. I mean, how absurd is this? And really, the whole country is up in arms about it, except for a few prosecutors and one judge, that an intelligence officer should defy orders in order to get information to the prime minister that he felt the prime minister was being deprived of. And this fellow is now sitting in prison for 60 days. It's insane. How could anyone say the prime minister is not allowed to know certain information?
It would be as if in this country someone made a decision and then incarcerated someone for trying to give information, important information, to the commander in chief.
It's exactly what happened here.
Unbelievable.
And Avi Rosenfeld, a nice young religious man, is sitting in prison. It's insane. It's not normal. But that's how the system the Marechet, both political and judicial, protects each other, covers for each other, and they don't care what's going on. That's the mentality of the army that thinks it has a country and not a country that has an army.
I don't know. I read the recent Parshios, and it just seems that we're such a better people than what we're displaying in this era, Robert Brzezinski. I don't know where we went wrong, frankly.
Right. Well, we have a choice. We could be, Amchocham v'Navon, wise and understanding people, or we can be an Amnavo v'Lochocham, a debased and foolish people. We always have a choice.
And sometimes we have to bemoan the choice that's made. Finally, we're speaking to Rabbi Stephen Brzezinski. I've asked you this before, but I think it may be a little bit more clear now because we see that there is supposedly new leadership in Lebanon. And since we last spoke, obviously Hezbollah has suffered a tremendous defeat, whatever that means for the moment. You just described how Hamas, under certain circumstances and likely ones, will survive all this, you know, and obviously you bemoan that fact, but we're looking at reality here. We're not hoping for it, but you're describing how things are going. Is it different up north? Is there really a chance for Hezbollah to be completely destroyed? And because the media is portraying the new leadership in Lebanon as being anti-Hezbollah, it makes that eventuality even more likely. How do you view that?
Well, firstly, I don't think Hamas has to survive. In fact, I think if there's no deal this week, they will not survive. They will be a whole placed on humanitarian aid. They will lose the symbols of governance over the people, and they will rapidly start disappearing.
So you're hoping when Trump says hell to pay, that's what he means. You're hoping that's what he means, not necessarily sending in thousands of soldiers to wipe out a place. You're talking about diplomatically there'll be hell to pay.
But what we do want is there's absolutely no obligation under international law and certainly under Torah morality to supply your enemy with provisions. Right. It's insane. You just prolong the war. But Hamas uses those provisions, they steal half of it, they sell to the people, but this way they retain in the eyes of the people symbols of governance. They're the shlitim, they're the rulers, right. They're the authorities.
We're taking care of you.
And that can stop, and that can be stopped within 30 to 60 days. Right. Now, just to go north, secondly, what's interesting about Hezbollah is Hezbollah is acting as a state within a state. Now, this new president, Yosef Aoun in Lebanon, former general, seems like a tough guy. He's not a big Zionist, but what he is apparently is a Lebanese nationalist. And I was watching a speech he gave, watching it last night, trying to work through the Arabic, or it was in Hebrew translation. And what he said was that we are not going to countenance weapons in the hands of any entity other than the state. All right? Well, he has spoken. Now let him enforce it. But if he wants to regain and reassert Lebanese sovereignty over Lebanese territory and not let a terror group, notwithstanding that they're part of the government and notwithstanding that they have tremendous support in Lebanon, if he wants to rein them in and say that we are not going to risk our polity in order to maintain the survival of this terrorist group, that too will be a big step forward for Israel.
Amazing. So there is some hope, at least in that. Well, there's hope in both cases, but certainly as you just described, there might be real hope in that case.
Well, that's correct. I think, I try to remain hopeful both in the north and the south and the east. One thing is true. The Mediterranean, our neighbor to the west, very calm, very placid, very peaceful. So there's always that.
And we see how the wonders of the one above can get somewhat temperamental. So thank God for that. Thank God the waters are calm at the moment. Thinking, of course, of our brothers and sisters, or I should say fellow residents and citizens of the United States that are going through what they're going through in California. And we've seen episodes, obviously, in Florida and Hawaii and other places where natural disasters can be very destructive. And as you just described, at least Israel has that, some calm waters to its west at the moment.
Right. The sea is our faithful friend. We can't say that of any of our neighbors.
So true. Rabbi Brzezinski, so appreciate your insight. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Rabbi Stephen Brzezinski, of course, he's in Israel. He is the Rabbi Emeritus here at Congregation B'nai Yeshurun in Teaneck, Regional Vice President of Israel for the Coalition for Jewish Values and Senior Research Associate, Jerusalem Center for Applied Policy. His contribution here is always welcome and appreciated. More coming up. You're listening to a Monday morning edition of JM in the AM.